I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The novelist and journalist Walter Kern found himself part of a real-life mystery when he realized that one of his longtime friends was playing him, and everyone else, as part of an elaborate con. Kern, the author of Up in the Air, has another book. This one tells the story of his unsuspecting friendship with Christian Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, who duped Walter Kern and others for years by pretending to be part of the Rockefeller dynasty. A skilled imposter, Gerhardsreiter was arrested by the FBI in Baltimore in 2008. He was later tried in Los Angeles for a 1985 murder. Walter Kern joins us to talk about Gerhardsreiter's long masquerade after the news from NPR. And welcome, everyone. Welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you again on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you for making Midday part of your day. In the summer of 2008, an international hunt for the man then known as Clark Rockefeller ended with his arrest in Baltimore's Mount Vernon neighborhood. The man known as Clark Rockefeller was wanted in the kidnapping of his 7-year-old daughter. FBI agents were tipped off to Rockefeller's presence by a real estate agent who had leased him a carriage house here. He had been living there for a short time. And while Rockefeller's daughter was found and returned to her mother unharmed, what wasn't known at that time was that Rockefeller, Clark Rockefeller, was more than a kidnapper. He was a serial con artist whose real name was and is Christian Carl Gerhardsreiter. Gerhardsreiter, a German national, had been involved in cons all over the country and had posed as a Rockefeller. And there's more. 5 years after his kidnapping arrest here, Gerhardsreiter was found guilty in the murder of a 27-year-old man named John Sohos, the son of a wealthy California widower who had been Gerhardsreiter's landlady. Sohos and his wife Linda disappeared without a trace in 1985. While the sensational story of this serial imposter and murderer has played out many times in the media, my guest this hour has special insight into the con man because for many years, he was an unsuspecting friend of his. Walter Kern is the author of Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. The book tells the story of Walter Kern's 10-year-plus relationship with Gerhardsreiter, who he then knew as Clark Rockefeller, like so many others before him. Walter Kern fell prey to Gerhardsreiter's many lies, and it wasn't until Rockefeller's kidnapping arrest in Baltimore that Walter Kern learned of Gerhardsreiter's true identity. Walter Kern is a prolific writer and journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. His novel, Up in the Air, was made into the 2009 film of the same name starring George Clooney. The book we're talking about today, again, the title Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. Walter Kern, welcome to Baltimore. It's nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Baltimore is important here because that's where this fellow known as Clark Rockefeller was arrested. But for you, it's sort of the halfway point of the story, isn't it? There was a Clark Rockefeller you knew before his arrest in August 2008. And then there was this other fellow you came to know after that.
Right. 2008, I'm sitting at my computer in Livingston, Montana, my home. And I've known Clark for 10 years. And for the last year or so, I'd been talking to him on the phone a lot about his upset over losing his daughter in a custody battle. I turn on the internet, and there's a nationwide manhunt for him. That was the beginning of the unraveling of his act. And it was the moment when the trap door opened for me, and I realized my friend was not at all who he said he was.
There had been an Amber Alert for his daughter. The FBI found him here in Baltimore. They lured him out of this apartment that he had it was suggested by a man who owned a marina.
Yeah.
Where Clark Rockefeller, or Gerhardsreiter, had a catamaran.
Yeah. He'd bought a catamaran. You know, he'd pre-planned this getaway. He took his daughter here to Baltimore. And he had a catamaran waiting for him in the harbor, which was famous throughout the harbor as a, a, a wreck of a boat, something that was probably going to sink. I think he was probably intending to fake his own death, going to push that thing out to sea or drag it out there, throw some clothes overboard and make it seem that Clark Rockefeller had met, a watery end, but it didn't work.
The man who owned the marina didn't think much of the boat either, and he referred to it as chainsaw food and estimated its worth at $5,000. This is in a story in the Baltimore Sun at the time. Mm-hmm. Gerhardt's writer had paid $10,000 in cash for the thing to a man named Bruce Boswell, and I just want to share this quote with you. In fact, you probably came across this in doing your research, but for our listeners, Bruce Boswell, a North Baltimore man who had sold his catamaran to this fellow Rockefeller, said he talked a big story. Mm-hmm. He's a very engaging guy with big ideas. I trusted him completely. Mm-hmm. And he recalled that this fellow Rockefeller, Clark Rockefeller, had met him at an office in Fells Point, to which he had the security code to open the door, but didn't seem to have an office there. That's where they met to close the deal on this catamaran.
I think that may have been a real estate office that he used to buy his house. He talked the real estate agents into letting him use the office when he was in town. I'm pretty sure that would have been the place. He got me in, when I knew him, into a art museum up at Dartmouth College that he claimed his aunt had given to the college and talked his way past the security guard on a day it was closed. So he was very good at that kind of thing.
This is a great story. I must say, when I remember his being arrested here in Baltimore, remember, wow, a member of the Rockefeller family on the lam. That's a hell of a story. gee, where did that come from? Because it was all new to us here. This story just sort of exploded within a few days. There was the Amber Alert. Sure enough, the FBI is looking for this Clark Rockefeller, I think, on a yacht. They suspected him being on a yacht, and he ends up in Baltimore.
He had a specific alias for his life in Baltimore, Chip Smith. He called himself Chip Smith, and he said he was a yacht captain or a boat captain of some kind, and he'd been sailing in the Caribbean or near South America, and people who met him said, but why don't you have a tan? And he said, well, it was raining the whole time. So he had a whole different identity that he used locally.
Let's go back 10 years earlier. Mm-hmm. Because folks are probably wondering, Walter Kern, you live in Montana. You're the novelist, journalist Walter Kern. You're a writer up there in Montana. How did you get to know this fellow?
My wife at the time ran the local animal shelter, and they got in a dog that had been run over and hit by a car, was paralyzed in its back end, and used a wheelchair to get around. It was a special needs dog. Its care was expensive, and they put it up for adoption on the internet and got a call back from New York City. Clark Rockefeller of New York City said, I'd love to adopt this dog. Two problems. I don't have a driver's license. I can't come out there and get it. And my private jet's in China with my wife. So they put me on the phone with this guy saying, maybe you can talk to him, Walter. You went to Princeton. You used to live in New York. Maybe speak this guy's language. And when I met him on the phone, he was such an eccentric. He called himself a freelance central banker. That's what he said his job was. I thought, as a novelist, I have to meet this guy. So I drove the dog to New York City.
As a novelist or as a journalist? I mean, as a novelist, it sounds like great stuff, doesn't it? It sounds like the stuff of novels.
Yes. I got to say, I had my own motives for wanting to meet him. And one was that I thought he would make a great character in a novel someday. Maybe I could even tell the true story of this trip with the dog, sort of like Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck. But once I got to know him, I thought, I can't exploit his confidence. He cares about his privacy.
So you're taking him seriously. You're driving this crippled dog to New York.
Yeah.
You don't actually finish driving the whole way. I think you flew half of the way.
Yeah,
right?
I got to Minnesota halfway and pretty much had a nervous breakdown. The dog was so uncomfortable. It was incontinent. It was a horrible trip.
So you flew the rest of the way to New York to deliver this dog to this Rockefeller. And you're thinking the whole time, this really is happening. I'm bringing a dog. Injured dog, crippled dog, from Montana to New York to a Rockefeller.
Oh, I remember checking into a motel room in Montana the first night I was out on the road, and they had a no pets policy. And I said, no, you got to understand two things. This dog is crippled, and I'm doing a favor for a Rockefeller bringing it out east, you know. I liked telling the story along the way because it sounded so weird. I was kind of practicing for when I might write, you know,
Right. Right. But you thought once you met Clark Rockefeller,
yeah,
you thought, well, I can't really take advantage of this situation and exploit this story, so I'm not going to write this magazine.
No. You know, I'm from a small town in Minnesota, and even though I went out into the wide world to become a writer, I still have those sort of Mayberry values, and I thought, oh, he's a friend. He's a real person. I can't use him.
So he was convincing.
Oh, totally convincing. When I went to his apartment the first time I met him, first weekend in New York City, he showed me what was maybe $50, $60 million worth of art. You know, Pollocks, Rothkos, all these abstract expressionist paintings. While I was looking at it, a restorer from the Museum of Modern Art came in and cleaned the paintings. With props like that, you believe that the show is real.
The first night you met him, you flew into New York.
Yeah.
So you meet him at an airport, and he strikes you, you make a note here that he strikes you as just eccentric enough to be like some other people that you've known from that realm of society.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went to Oxford after Princeton, and I was friends with Princess Di's brother, Charles Althorp, Viscount Charles Althorp, and his friends. And let me tell you, you know, these real aristocrats were as eccentric and goofy and had strange hobbies as anyone can imagine. And so he didn't seem that much different in a way. I mean, he told me he'd never eaten in a restaurant. He'd never tasted a Coca-Cola, things like this. And I thought, oh, he's a sheltered, kind of fragile butterfly of a man, you know.
Who had the keys to Rockefeller Center, he claimed.
Yeah, first night I ate with him, we were in a skyscraper looking down on Rockefeller Center, a private dining room. And after dinner, he patted the pocket of his blazer and said, would you like to take a tour of the family's place? And he nodded out the window at Rockefeller Center, and he said, I have the key right here, the master key. And you know, that blew my mind. For some reason, we didn't end up going. It was sort of like a little late and maybe some other time. But,
right, maybe some other time.
Yeah.
I can't help it. I'm sure you get this question a lot. There's the pre-Baltimore story and the post-Baltimore story. There's the pre-arrest of Clark Rockefeller, and then there's Mr. Gerhardt's writer, right?
Right.
So looking back now, do you think you were gullible at all, or do you think he had surrounded himself with enough trappings and that he was just eccentric enough to convince you or anyone that he was who he said he was, a descendant, a member of the Rockefeller dynasty?
My book really analyzes what it is in our interactions that causes us to trust people, because he manipulated all the mechanisms of trust. One of them was to have expensive possessions, or at least appear to, this art. Another was to go into very exclusive places, like these private clubs where we ate in New York where I stayed on his ticket in Boston. You know, you figure if other people think somebody is eminent and wealthy, you figure they are too. I had no reason to doubt him and every reason to believe him, and he had set it up such that he had other people vouching for him. He'd created a lot of evidence for his pose and then put it in front of me. So even though he seemed like a braggart and an eccentric and maybe even at times a bit of a kook, I'd never doubted that he was not who he said he was.
We're going to take our first break here on Midday in our conversation with Walter Kern, author of Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade, which details Walter Kern's 10-year or more friendship with the serial con artist, later convicted murderer, Christian Karl Gerhardtsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller. Stay with us. And this is Midday with Dan Rodericks. Thanks again for listening in today. Walter Kern is our guest, the novelist and journalist whose work has appeared in many publications, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine. His novel, Up in the Air, was made into the 2009 film of the same name, starring George Clooney. What did you think of the film, by the way?
I thought it was great. It was very different than the book. The book was a lot darker and sort of psychological than the movie. But, you know, whenever they keep the title and make a good movie, whether or not it preserves everything in the book, you're happy as a writer. You just don't want them to ruin the name of your book forever. You
know? Walter Kern's new book is Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade, the story of Christian Carl Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, whom you knew for 10 years before his arrest in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Now, let's go back to that. So he was arrested in Baltimore for the kidnapping of his 7-year-old daughter,
mm-hmm.
Not for what he was later convicted of.
Right.
So I guess we should go there. 5 years later, he's on trial for a murder in California, a murder that alleged to have occurred in 1985.
Yeah. Well, you know, back in 1985, he was in his early 20s. He was living under the name Baronet Christopher Chichester, a minor British aristocrat, he said. He was living in the guest house of a rich woman in San Marino, California, which is sort of between Pasadena and Los Angeles. And he was charged with killing the son of the old woman, a 27-year-old young guy who was into computers, kind of a Dungeons and Dragons guy. He cut him up, buried him in the yard. He played a game of Trivial Pursuit on the grave with his friends who didn't know it was a grave. They thought it was a mound of dirt from plumbing problems. The wife was never found, and the son was only found 9 years later when they excavated a swimming pool in the yard. He almost got away with that crime.
1985. So he's posing as a British aristocrat.
Yeah.
And he's paying rent. He has money as he's able to pay rent to the landlady?
Presumably. You know, he had a talent for charming old ladies. So until we see the checks that he paid, one can presume that maybe he wasn't, that he was doing favors. But in any case, people who went into his apartment or his guest house at that time said it was very shabbily furnished for someone who was going around outside, you know, pretending to be related to the Queen, which he did.
Walter, when did we find out about these charges?
Yeah.
He was picked up for the kidnapping of his daughter in Baltimore
in
August 2008. When did we find out that he was a suspect in a murder?
It was in the next few weeks. The bad news on this guy all came cascading out pretty quickly after the FBI got him. First, that he wasn't a Rockefeller, which I, when I heard it, didn't believe. I thought the Rockefeller family was disowning him because he'd brought scandal on their name. I went around ranting and raving to my girlfriend and other journalists that the Rockefellers were cowards and wouldn't own up to being, you know, related to this guy. Then, you know, it came out a few weeks later that he was a suspect in this old cold case murder. And I knew, hearing some of the details of the murder, instantly that he was guilty, that in my mind he was guilty.
You know, it sounds like he became a good friend of yours. I mean, maybe not a close, intimate friend, but
yeah,
somebody you liked, someone you kept in touch with over the years?
Yeah. I mean, when I reverse engineer the relationship and realize that the whole time I knew him, he was a fugitive from justice who was living under another name and, you know, insulating himself from all contact with the authorities, I'm surprised he had any friends at all. You know, we related mostly by phone in the last few years of our relationship. But, you know, I found him to be an amusing guy. He wasn't especially charismatic, but he knew how to tell a story. And his stories were all, you know, unlikely and some of them, you know, ridiculously funny.
I'm going to go back to the murder and the trial in just
yeah.
a minute. But it seems like there's a lot of territory that we need to cover there.
Sure.
Those 10 years of your friendship and staying in touch with him. You mentioned that you were up at Dartmouth with him at
yeah.
one point. He had a country house in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
would you fill in some of this for us? Because I'm very curious about how he lived, who he said he was.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have a job of any kind?
Well, let me tell you a story about visiting him in New Hampshire. 2002, he says, come on out. I've got a country place. He'd moved from New York by that time. I drove up there from Boston, and this mansion of his was falling apart. It was up on jacks. The windows were missing. He said it was under construction. We went out to dinner. He told me to order anything I wanted. Then after I had done so, he told me he'd forgotten his wallet, so I paid. That weekend, he told me that it was too bad I hadn't come the week before because Britney Spears, his friend Britney Spears, had just been staying with him. And Next week, his friend Chancellor Kohl of Germany was coming to stay with him. And I don't think those two names have ever been uttered in the same sentence in all of history. And so I say this to give you a sense of how outlandish his lies were, but they were more convincing for that reason, because they weren't the kind of lies I could imagine anyone telling, unless they were, you know, totally insane. And he wasn't insane. But I spent that weekend with him, and I came away thinking, this guy's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a pest. I mean, and I tried to distance myself from him after that, but he made sure to stay in touch. And when he lost his daughter in a divorce in 2006, I was already divorced and too had a daughter that I didn't see as much as I wanted. And so we kind of rebonded over our pain as single fathers. And that was the stage our relationship was at when he kidnapped his daughter. And I, at first, when it was just a kidnapping, sort of understood in a strange way. I thought, well, he cracked, you know, the grief or the, you know, sense of loss was too much.
So that you think that was genuine? Because it's
actually
hard to...
no, okay. I don't.
It's hard to tell, you know, what's genuine.
Nothing.
I'm starting to think maybe he had this father moment where he really was torn up about being separated from a 7-year-old daughter.
No.
So there's nothing genuine about this man.
This book goes into detail about my relationship, but I also was at his murder trial, and I got to talk to other people who'd known him, and I did a lot of research. Scratch the surface, and all emotion with him is faked. This dog he got from me in a wheelchair, he used to walk it around Central Park every day, and people, of course, would come up and say, oh, what happened to your dog? You know, it was the perfect front for a man with no emotions to pretend he was human. He was kidnapping his daughter because he could not bear to lose. He could never lose. His premise in life was that he was a genius and everybody else was stupid, an idiot. And when he lost the poker game of his divorce and custody battle, he vowed to get her back. And he was even like that on the phone, just fuming over his wife having sort of won this battle.
One of the things that I find interesting about the stories you're telling about your encounters with him, the story about Helmut Kohl and mm-hmm. Britney Spears having been there the week before or something. And you say you came away thinking, well, this guy's kind of a jerk, meaning to me that, all right, he's a friend, he's an acquaintance of mine, but I don't really trust him. Or there's something wrong here, something he's not telling me. And if it's hard to be friends with someone who isn't fully honest with you.
Yes.
Right?
You know, I concluded that he was very insecure. He was fascinated by the fact that I was a writer. And over the years, he sort of intimated that he did a lot of writing, too, and that he had some novels he'd been working on for years. And when I finally pressed him to ask him what the novels were about, he told me that they were novelizations of Star Trek episodes, which was very strange. And he also told me at one point that he had a secret laboratory in Quebec, a company he owned that was researching jet propulsion for NASA and the Defense Department. And one day he asked me if I'd like to see a picture of this secret laboratory. I said, sure. And he pulled out a picture of a forest taken from the air, almost by like a satellite or something. And he said, it's right under all those trees. That's where the lab is. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, big baloney, but...
Did you walk away thinking it was baloney?
I didn't know what to think. I thought, why is this guy... I didn't think of him as outright lying. I just thought, why does this guy need to do this? He's a Rockefeller, for heaven's sake.
Rockefellers don't brag?
Well, I concluded that they must. You know, from what he told me about his life, he'd grown up an orphan, very lonely. He'd gone to Yale when he was 14. He didn't have any friends. His sister was in a mental hospital. I thought, you know, he's like a guy without human contact who's gone a little nutty.
A sociopath?
I had no idea he was a sociopath. No idea, not until I went to his trial.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Our guest is Walter Kern, author of Blood Will Out, The true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. This is the story of Christian Carl Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller. What do we know now about Gerhardsreiter, that man, in Germany, once upon a time? What do we know about his youth?
Well, he came over here at 17. He was hitchhiking one day in the rain when he was 17, and some Americans picked him up. He brought them home to dinner. They said, if you're ever in the United States, give us a call. 2 weeks later, he was in the United States, and he gave him a call. His town was a very small, sort of out-of-the-way, kind of pious Roman Catholic town in Bavaria. By all accounts, a kind of very boring place to grow up. But people ask me constantly if there's any evidence. Was he abused? Was he traumatized? Was he treated badly? Because in this country, we want to believe that anybody who does something bad does it because something bad happened to them. And there's really no evidence that anything did. From a very young age, he was kind of a bully and a meanie and a trickster. And people say, you know, what happened to him that he became a murderer? And I say, he was born.
So you think it was all there?
I think it was all there.
It's the bad seed.
I think it's the bad seed theory. You know, that's not very popular anymore. But, you know, he used to come up to people and hold his hand closed and say, look in my hand, see what I got. And they'd put their eyes up and he'd blow pepper up their into their eyes and nose, you know.
What is it about the con man? Because I know you spent a lot of time thinking about this, your own experience, and reading about other situations where the fraud has been committed. You know, we know of con men over the years, imposters who pose to be something they're not in order to gain financially, to gain some money that from somebody else. I know of one personally myself from my experience as a journalist in Baltimore, or a couple, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But was that it for him? What motivated Clark Rockefeller, Christian Gerhardsreiter?
What motivated him was, I think, what motivates, you know, top poker players: the need to win, the need to be in on the action, the love of the game. He liked fooling people. He liked proving his premise that he was the smartest person in the world. You know, after he murdered John Sohus, like I say, he had over his friends and set up a card table on the dirt mound and played Trivial Pursuit, so that he could sit there and go, I know something you don't know. That was his life goal, to always be the one who knew something you didn't.
So it was the game for him. And to win, you said in the custody battle, too, the reason he kidnapped his daughter was because he didn't like losing in that custody battle.
I think that was the emotional reason. I also think that he was leaving the country for other reasons. And if he hadn't, in Boston, been able to hustle her into a car, if he'd had to leave her there, I think he would have been leaving the country anyway.
Walter Kern, you're not alone in this. I mean, there are other people who had encounters with Clark Rockefeller, mm-hmm. mostly in the, I would say, the high society of New England, Boston area in particular, who must have felt the same way they got to know this fellow.
You know what? One thing I conclude in the book is that the upper class in America is itself kind of a phony construction. It's an imitation of the British upper classes. And, you know, they wear polo shirts, you know, made by the Ralph Lauren company. Ralph Lauren, not his real name, by the way. And so the whole thing is kind of counterfeit. And Clark very easily decoded what you're supposed to do to pass in that. Don't wear socks, you know, speak in a lockjawed way, and so on. And the people he fooled were the people who really were what he was pretending to be.
Did he really believe that you could pass yourself off as a wealthy American, an aristocrat, so to speak, by imitating Thurston Howell III?
Well, according to a young man who had lived with him when he first came to the United States, Clark stayed with a host family, he would study the show Gilligan's Island and watch Jim Backus's The Millionaire character and form his voice after that, yeah.
Walter Kern is our guest in this hour of Midday. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. His latest book is Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. It's published by Liverite, right?
Yeah, division of Norton, yes.
Liverite. All right, very good. We'll take a short break here, Walter, and pick up our conversation in just a moment. Retracing the story of Christian Carl Gerhardt. Hartz-Reiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, who was arrested in Baltimore, as we've mentioned here a couple of times, August 2008, when the FBI caught up with him. And a little bit more from the Baltimore Sun's story at that time, Walter Kern. This Mr. Boswell, who sold him the catamaran in Baltimore that we mentioned earlier, the two became friendly, sharing a drink at a neighborhood bar. Rockefeller, Clark Rockefeller, described his plans to purchase the historic Mayflower Theater in West Baltimore from the city of Baltimore and restore it. He talked about his friends at the Century Club, a Tony New York City social center. But Mr. Boswell observed the man said negative things about women. It doesn't elaborate much on there. We know that, you know, he had a divorce and a custody battle with his wife. This is what led to his arrest in Baltimore because he kidnapped his daughter. What about his wife? Who did he marry, Christian Gerhartz-Reiter?
Her name was Sandra Boss. He married her in 1994. He met her at a costume party themed after the board game Clue, in which he came as Professor Plum. You know, he was, unbeknownst to everybody, reenacting this murder that he'd committed as a costume party diversion. Anyway, she was a Harvard MBA on her way up. She worked for the McKinsey Management Consultancy, a global firm where she ultimately became a partner and was making millions of dollars a year. She testified at the murder trial that he was taking almost all of the money. He would abuse her over any expenditures, out-of-the-way expenditures, and he was using it to buy his fake art, renovate his mansion in Cornish, and finance what other scams we don't really know.
Do we know if he took any money from wealthy people in the Boston area?
Not that we know of. No one's come forward to say they were taken by him. But one of the things about con artists is they depend on the shame of the victims. You know, there are a lot of people who knew him who have admitted to me they knew him but won't say so publicly because they think it reflects poorly on them.
You're admitting that you liked knowing a Rockefeller.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly got my attention. And when the Rockefeller seemed to like me, I mean, oh, well, you know, what can I can't help it. People say, how did he get you to trust him? And in a weird way, he did it by trusting me, by appearing to trust me, you know, letting me bring him this dog. Only I could do it. Telling me that I was his best friend because everybody else wanted something from him, but I didn't. You know, he laid it on thick, and he knew that a person's vanity is the way to their, heart, really.
Let's go back to the murder. First, I wanted to ask you this. Pardon me if I asked you about it earlier.
Sure.
But when you found out that he was a suspect in a 1985 murder, this man you'd known for 10 years, who you thought merely had snapped and kidnapped his daughter
because
he was upset about the custody situation. Now you're hearing that he's suspected in a California murder, a cold case from 1985. What was your reaction to that?
Well, in the first reports of the murder, they said that the suspect at the time, which was Clark under another name, was living in a guest house on the property of the victim. I immediately went back to a moment in 1998, a couple of months after I'd met him, when he asked me if he'd come out to Montana and live on my ranch. And I said, there's no room. It's a little house. He says, well, do you have a guest house? And I said, yeah, I've got a little guest place. And he said, well, I used to live in a guest house, and I've never been happier in all my life. And when I heard that detail from the murder investigation and that conversation came back into my head, it was like a box slammed shut, and I went guilty.
I mean, I can hear that.
Yeah.
You hear the word guest house, and you had just heard it in the news.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's talk about the trial. The trial was only in 2013, right? The evidence from a cold case, this must have been a tough one. From 1985, was it mostly circumstantial evidence? What would you say about the prosecution of Gerhartz-Reiter?
Well, the prosecution was a masterful work of legal art because, you know, most of the witnesses were from 1984. Some of them were very, very old. They hadn't found the body for 9 years, so there were hardly any remains. It was mostly just photographs of remains. A lot of them had been lost by the coroner, the actual bones. And a lot of the evidence was, you know, he happened to borrow a chainsaw around this time. A neighbor smelled horrible smoke coming from the chimney of the guest house, and it turned out he was burning the carpet for some reason. It was a real patchwork of these circumstantial clues that the jury had to work with. And I remember sitting at the trial thinking, this jury is going to find this guy not guilty. He's going to fool them one last time, and then he's going to walk out of here some kind of horrible celebrity.
You remember feeling that way during the trial?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't have much faith. Yeah. I thought, if this guy can walk into Kidder Peabody's investment bank and get a job off the street, he's going to fool this jury, too.
What was the motive? Did the state have to present a motive?
In California, they don't have to present a motive for murder. But I knew from talking to the detectives that he had a kind of complicated motive. Number one, he may have wanted to inherit the mother's money and portray... he made it seem that the son and daughter were off in Europe by sending back postcards from them, even though they were buried in the yard, that were forwarded from Paris saying they were having a great time. So the mother would have thought that her son and daughter-in-law were just off ignoring her, gallivanting around, and you know, he would have tried to get into the will. Instead, he got a local couple to pay him to take care of the old lady, and those people got in the will. And then he showed up when she died a couple of years later to split the take from the will, and there really wasn't anything left. But I think he had a more complicated motive. He loved film noir. He loved movies like, you know, Double Indemnity and Dial M for Murder.
Diabolique?
Exactly. And he, a lot of the techniques that he used in the murder and the cover-up are drawn from novels and movies. And I think that finally, as a con artist, he just wanted to graduate to the big league and see if he could pull off the perfect murder.
Wow. So you don't go for the first one so much because there wasn't much of a payoff. Right?
There wasn't much of a payoff. And when you think about murdering somebody so that maybe someday their mother, when she finally dies, I mean, she wasn't on her deathbed then, will put you in the will. That's a pretty long-term and dicey motive. I think it would have been a fringe benefit. But I think he wanted to murder. He made a little student movie with a friend a couple of months before the murder in which he kills a woman. I think he was relishing the thought.
And the wife, this is a young, fairly young couple in their 20s. So whose was what, 27?
27, yeah.
His wife, Linda, who has never been found.
Never been found.
So, I mean, what does the state say about that, if anything? Do you get anything from anyone on that?
The state couldn't really claim anything in the murder trial since the body was never found. Counter the defense's argument, which was that the wife committed the murder. You know, when I saw Clark in jail afterwards, he said, oh, the wife did it. The wife did it. But of course, I think he killed her and she's buried somewhere nearby, you know, out there in Los Angeles. That's what the detectives think, too.
I have a little news to report to you, Walter. Bruce Boswell has called the show. Bruce Boswell is that man I mentioned earlier in the show who sold the catamaran to Gerhardt's writer, then known as, well, in Baltimore, known as Chip Smith, right?
Right, yeah.
Or Chip McLaughlin, I think, was another name he used here.
Yeah.
Bruce, are you on the line? Bruce Boswell?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you very much for calling. What can you tell us about Clark Rockefeller?
Well, when you said that the Sun Paper article did not mention or go into more detail about him not liking women.
Mm-hmm.
He had this fantastic story that he told me that he and some other investors owned a ranch in California, and they were interested in setting up one of these type of ranches in Maryland, and he was looking for investors. And what they would do at this ranch is they would bring Eastern European women.
I know what you're going to say.
Right, let's
to the United States.
Well, you've heard this story.
Well, yeah. Let Bruce finish.
Go ahead, Bruce. Yeah.
And they would come over on 6-month visas, and they would elicit wealthy men who wanted to have a baby with no woman who could make a claim on the baby. They would bring these women over, pay them $50,000, and the deal was that wealthy man could pay $350,000, And the investors would have this ranch where the women would come. They'd be impregnated by these wealthy men or artificially inseminated. We didn't go into that detail, but they would come. The babies would come to be born 9 months later, and these women would have outstayed their six-month visas and would be deported, and thereby lose any claim over the child, which would then be given to the man.
Bruce,
in advance of him kidnapping the his own daughter.
His own daughter. Bruce, stay on the line, would you, for a minute? I'm sorry, yeah. Walter, I got to go to you because it sounds like this is familiar to you.
Oh, yeah. On the phone a few months before he kidnapped his daughter, he outlined the same scheme. It wasn't based in America on a ranch. He said it was going to be in Peru or somewhere in the third world. But the last time I spoke to him was the time he described this business proposal. He thought I might be interested in, having a child by this means because, maybe I hated women as much as he did. And I was sick of him after that, and I never talked to him again.
Bruce, I'm
well, he said that California and Maryland, and I don't know if it's true or not, but are the two states in the union where on the birth certificate, it can actually say unknown, that that's a permitted option.
What a freak.
That's why Maryland and California were places he thought these ranches made sense.
Hey, Bruce, let me ask you something, because I know you were quoted in The Sun here. I quoted this story from, 6 years ago now, 2008. This is before he was charged with in a murder. And I wonder, what was your reaction when you heard that the man you knew as Clark Rockefeller was charged with a murder?
Well, I thought it was amazing because even though he seemed quite unusual, a chap, I've never sat down and had a drink with someone who I later find out was a murderer. So, I just felt comfortable with him, even though, he had these wild stories. I felt comfortable because he seemed legitimate, even though it was kind of fantastic, these stories he was telling. And I wasn't going to get involved with him. I was happy to sell my boat, which, by the way, the boat, wasn't pretty, but it was the fastest boat. We could challenge any boat in the Patapsco and win. So it wasn't pretty. Right. It wasn't a pretty boat, but it was a fast one.
A 26-foot catamaran owner of the marina said he referred to as a chainsaw food.
Yeah, that manager of the marina is no longer there.
Okay.
not for that reason, right. But...
Well, Bruce, I'm impressed that you called, and I appreciate you calling with that story. Thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah,
Bruce,
good day to you.
Yeah, good day.
Bye-bye.
That's an outlandish story, but he told me virtually the same thing, so it's nice to hear it confirmed.
Your theory on it was that he came to Baltimore... He was going to stage his own death, possibly.
Yeah, he was either going to stage his own death. He had a friend in Peru, and he'd told me that Peru did not extradite fathers from America who took their children. And I think he was either going to stage his own death and or somehow catch a freighter. This friend had a shipping company and go down to Peru with the daughter. Weirdly, that friend in Peru, I know this from watching Peruvian TV on the internet, kidnapped his own daughter a couple years ago after making the mother sign a document giving up rights to the child, just like the scheme that Boswell talked about a minute ago. Mm. So they were involved in something crazy.
Could the catamaran, if it was in bad shape, could have been part of this scheme?
Well, he was either going to sail it out to a boat, like I say, and join a freighter, and or sink it, maybe as part of the same scheme, in order to throw people off his trail. He didn't have ID. There was no way he could fly out of the country. He couldn't drive a car. He got to Baltimore by getting people to drive him and so on. So his options were limited.
What was it like when you spoke with him in prison?
It was one of the scariest things I've ever done, because here I am looking through this pane of plexiglass at a guy who I last saw as Clark Rockefeller, in a blue blazer and a bow tie or whatever. And here he is in prison garb, and I know that not only did he kill somebody, he chopped him up into pieces and wrapped him in plastic and buried him in a yard and played a game on the grave. And I'm looking into his eyes from 4 inches away through this pane of glass, and I see what I know to be the most monstrous individual I've ever met in my life. And it frightened me.
Did you? When was the last time you had a conversation with him? Was it
not
after the conviction, or were these all before the conviction?
No. You see, he wasn't allowed by his attorneys to talk to anyone after his kidnapping trial in 2008, and he was only convicted of murder exactly a year ago. He fired his lawyers, and then suddenly he was available for visits, so I started visiting him exactly a year ago. The last time I saw him was August 25th, 2013, after his sentencing, and his first words to me, because he knew I was writing about him, were, "You betrayed me." You know, he turned it around on me.
You betrayed him.
I betrayed him.
How did you betray him? By writing about him?
Yeah, a gentleman apparently didn't tell secrets, you know. By that time, I didn't care. I mean, I'm going to tell you honestly, a lot of this book is motivated by anger and a sense of wanting to turn the tables on somebody who took advantage of me.
Well, that feeling of betrayal,
yeah,
right? Is it part of that feeling of having been had?
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to fess up to, actually. As you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of people who knew Clark Rockefeller who won't admit to it today.
You know, there's a phrase in the world of con artistry called cooling out the mark. It means, after you've taken somebody's trust, you calm them down before you take off. You know, he never got a chance to calm me down. When I found out what a fake he was, the anger remained fresh until I watched him convicted of murder. And he took away my ability to walk down the street and trust the people I meet, to go on the internet and, you know, trust that the Facebook friend is really who they say they are. You know, people say, "What did he steal from you? He didn't steal money." No, he stole my faith in other human beings.
Do you really feel that today? I mean, like,
to
when you drive around in your truck or whatever, you see...
To some extent. Yeah, I mean...
Encounter somebody new, maybe? You're a little more leery than you were before?
Oh, obviously. I mean, I remember a few months after he was outed, a plumber saying, you know, "Give me your key while you're on vacation. I'll come in and fix your pipes." And I couldn't do it. You know, I just... it's subtle, but once you've been taken... you're not the same person.
We should say that Christian Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, is serving a sentence of 27 to life. Is that right?
Well, life is actually 27 years in his case. That's what that's what a life sentence is in California. And he's talked himself into a minimum security prison, though, I hear, as of a couple weeks ago, which is crazy.
His story to you about the murder is... the wife, Linda, did it and disappeared.
Yeah.
Is that right?
He was kind of like O.J. in jail. You remember how O.J. said he had a team of investigators who were going to find out who really killed his wife? Well, Clark in jail said, Linda did it, and we know where she is. Maybe you'll help find her. I don't know who "we" was supposed to be, him and his attorneys.
Walter, did he present any of that at his trial and his defense?
No.
So they didn't even raise that theory.
No. I guess. Well, they did suggest she did it, but they never went into how or where she might be hiding. And the prosecution did a good job of proving that since that day when her husband disappeared, not a blip had ever come up in any record anywhere in the country of Linda's existence. So she's gone. She's gone.
Walter Kern is the author of Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade, the story of Carl Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, and his long, unsuspecting friendship with him. Walter, this has been great, and it's a great book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Great story. Thank you. Thank you very much for visiting us.
Fun talking here.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our midday first hour. And I want to mention that Walter Kern, our guest in this hour of the show, will be appearing tonight, Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014, at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop, located up on Falls Road. So you can find him there at 7 o'clock. He'll be signing copies of his book, Blood Will Out.